All right. Tonight, it's a great pleasure. I thought he had spoken here before. Again, my name is Toby, and I'm an alcoholic. I get to introduce a young man, I call him, because he's much younger than me. And he has a very, very strong story. He's one of those that, had to work at trying to get this program, but once it hit with a ball of fire, and he definitely comes straight out of the book, and he definitely has a strong grasp on recovery. I know he's gone through the steps, and I know that he brings those steps to others. He's always reaching out a hand to help another person. If I see recovery, I see it in him. He's a great example. He is a copy of this big book, Living. And with that, and much no further ado, Mr. Dominic B.
Thank you. I am a recovered alcoholic named Dominic. So, war fever ran high in the New England town. Wait a minute. That's not my story. That's someone else's. Somewhere before, right? We should hope so. Anyway, we usually, talk about, what we used to be like, what we're like now, and what happened in between. And I don't want to get too much into, a drink-a-thon or a drug-a-thon or, I think we all know how to drink and drug pretty, successfully around here, or should I say unsuccessfully. So I don't think I need to get into too much of how deep my addictions took me. But my earliest memories, of drinking and drugging, my father was an alcoholic. And that was the environment I grew up in. He was also a dealer. He dealt weed, so it was a very common thing, to have a house full of people, loud music, drinking, everybody partying. And that was a normal life to me. That's what seemed normal. And that's what I grew up in for as long as I can remember. And I remember sneaking... sneaking beers and sneaking drinks at a real young age. When I was 16, my father decided that I was a man, and he got me pissed drunk. I mean, violently drunk. And we were drinking Bloody Marys, and I remember there were tall glasses, and it was mostly vodka with just a little bit of V8 juice for coloring, and I when I smell V8 juice, it makes me nauseous. After the sixth one, I fell off the floor, fell off the chair onto the floor, and after the eighth one, I was out back puking, and after the tenth one, I remember laying on my waterbed with one foot planted on the ground, wanting the world to stop moving. And I remember my mother yelling at me from the door, "Oh, you're a big man, aren't you?" And I'm like, "Leave me alone," and I swore that day I would never drink again. Guess what? That didn't happen. That was just a prelude to some, deeper drinking. I dropped out of school at the age of 16 in the ninth grade. My mother had become disabled, so I was working and going to school, trying to take care of my side of, of the street, try to help out the family. My mother was diagnosed with lupus. So I dropped out of day school and I started attending school at night at Robinson, and which I didn't stick with. I wound up eventually just taking my GED and getting it over with, getting that good enough diploma. And I started to work for my best friend's parents, who were locksmiths. And I thought, wow, this is great. I don't need to go to college. Here's a trade right here. And I did that. And And eventually work got slow and he couldn't afford to keep me on, so I went through a spree of minimum wage jobs. And finally, at the age of 19, I decided I was going to go into the Navy, you know, make something out of myself. So right before I went into the Navy, I was seeing a much older woman. I was 20, she was 35. And I think what really attracted me to this one, because it was a real big taboo, she was married to a lieutenant in the sheriff's department, and I'm like, yeah, I'm with a cop's wife, and I just thought I was the shit, you know. And, well, make a long story short, she left him for me, you know, a real stroke to my ego, and she became pregnant. And so I'm like, great, you know. Oh, let me back up in my story. My girlfriend at 16 became pregnant, and so there's an older son that her parents and my parents got in this huge argument, and I was forbidden to see her, and that caused a lot of depression for me, and I started using on a daily basis afterwards. Also, attempted suicide at 16, was Baker acted for the very first time. So anyways, fast forward, you know, 3 years in the future, I'm 19 going into the Navy. You know, finally thinking I'm going to, you know, get my act together and everything. So I get shipped off to San Diego. And I spent 22 days in basic training until I washed out. They had the moment of truth, and I had omitted the fact that I had been committed to a mental hospital when I was 16. I had omitted that on my application, and they scare you. They're like, you better tell us now, because if we find out later, you're going to, you know, all these. So I was scared, and I went, and I told them, and they sent me to the Navy psychiatrist, who at first was going to let me stay. You know, I had convinced him that, you know, I wanted to be there and everything, and he asked me, he's like, do you have any children? And my wife had miscarried 2 weeks before I left for boot camp. And that question teared me up and made me cry. And he told me that the Navy was no place for me, because apparently I wasn't mentally stable. And so he sent me home. And that ended my Navy career 22 days later. So I came back to Tampa, pissed off and distraught, and immediately started drinking. That was another thing. My wife and I, you know, we could polish off a fifth a night, and we did that on a regular basis. Yet, I wasn't an alcoholic, mind you, okay? You know, my father, he was an alcoholic, and I couldn't keep up with him, and that's where I had placed that bar, because he, you know, He was the man when it came to drinking. You know, he could party all night, go to sleep for 3 hours, wake up and go to work. Which, you know, that he was the man. That was an alcoholic. And I also left out the fact that he was an abusive alcoholic. He beat my ass growing up badly. Would leave bleeding welts up and down my back. When I became 13, he said I was too big for the belt and started punching me. And that happened for a while until eventually I just became his drinking buddy. Then it was cool. We were friends. It was a real blurred line between father and son. Then it was more, you know, we're buddies. And that was cool because that was better attention than getting woke up in the middle of the night getting my ass beat for no reason at all. And that's what would happen. And still to today, you know, when people touch me when I'm asleep, I jump. Because, you know, I don't know if I'm about to get my ass beat or not. So, fast forward back to me getting out of the Navy. I came home. got a job working for Anderson News Company delivering magazines to, like, the grocery stores and stuff like that. Which, I mean, it was a shitty job, but it was a job. On my route one day, I ran into this old man who was a locksmith out in Plant City, and I started telling him, I grew up around the business. I've worked as a locksmith, blah, 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 blah. And I gave him my number, and a few weeks later, he calls me. A friend of his bought a business out in Plant City Lock and Key, and asked me if I wanted to come out there and work. I'm like, yeah, that's what I wanted since I was 16, so it was like, cool. So I went out there and I apprenticed for a couple years, and that's what I did, and that's how I became a locksmith. I ended up being a locksmith for 23 years, really good one. I told y'all that my mother was diagnosed with lupus. Well, at the age of 22, she passed. She caught a common cold that you and I would just, fight off no problem. But with her, it put her in intensive care, and in 3 days, she passed. And that, I mean, my mother was my world. I was, she was everything to me, and my whole world changed from that moment. I felt like I was walking around in a dream state. And 1 month after I buried her, my best friend was on his way back from Miami, and he died in a car accident. So it was like in 1 month's time, I had lost my mother and my best friend. And while I was taking time away, I had my own business. After I became a locksmith, I started my own business, and I took in a partner and everything was doing great. And I remember right before my mom passed, she came out to our shop. We had a shop out in Sefner, and she was like, "I'm so proud of you," because I had built something. I had a business. I had a service truck. I was married. Had a house. I was as far as I was concerned, I was living the dream. While I was taking time off to bury my mother, my business partner got drunk and totaled my van into the guardrail of I-4, so it put me out of business. So within a month's time, I felt like I lost everything. So I went to work for somebody else, and that was just the start of my spiral. I started staying out every night, getting drunk, getting wasted, started tripping on acid, this was back when ecstasy had first hit the scene, so I was taking ecstasy, I was just doing everything I could, and 2 years of my life became a complete blur, and my wife was struggling, miscarrying left and right. We had 6 miscarriages in a row, and when she was pregnant the 7th time, I had given up all hope, and once again, I was still out partying every day. So when she got pregnant that 7th time, I stayed away because I just didn't want to get let down one more time, All the times up to this one, I was like, I had that positive attitude. It's going to be different this time. It's going to be different this time. And something about this last one, I was just numb. I was like, no, not going through it again, And I stayed away, and I drank myself into a stupor. I stayed high as much as I could to bury my pain of all the loss I had in my life. I saw nothing. My whole world was a blur. I didn't want to live, but I was too chicken shit to kill myself. I was slowly trying to kill myself. And then and then my son was born. And when he was born, I remember it being the happiest day of my life. And for him, I tried to clean up. I tried to sober up. And I would make it a couple weeks, and then I'd slip. Then I'd make it a week. Then I'd slip. Then I'd make it 2 weeks. And then I'd slip. And this happened endlessly for a while. You know, and every time, you know, the wife would set me up. I mean, she knew that I had fucked up. And she would say, "I'm so proud of you." And she would sit there and let me lie to her, knowing that I had messed up. You know? But I would, you know, because I didn't know what the truth was. And I'd constantly lie to her. It was nothing new for me. You know, everything that came out of my mouth was a lie. So this went on for about his first year and a half. Then I just completely lost my mind. And in July of 97, I had a complete nervous breakdown. And I ended up being Baker acted. And I was Baker acted a few times. I get out, act up, and get Baker acted. Get out, act up, and get Baker acted. I ended up being committed for almost 60 days through all this. And during that time, in my time out, I had completely alienated myself from my wife. She had put an injunction against me. She had me arrested for domestic violence. So I was out and out for good, you know. And when I got out, I had 60 days clean. And I knew I'd lost everything. And I was like, well, maybe I should try going to a meeting. So that's when I started going to Narcotics Anonymous. And I went there, and I remember my very first meeting. I shared, and I started crying. I can't remember what I shared, and I can't remember much of that meeting, but I remember that I shared and cried for the rest of that meeting. The very next meeting I remember because I shared, and people laughed. And I thought they were laughing at me, and I got angry. Got up and picked up chairs and started throwing them. Because I thought they were laughing at me. Later I found out that they were laughing with me because they understood. But, you know, it was all about me at that time, you know, and they were laughing at me. And, you know, who the hell are you to laugh at me is what my, you know, was my thinking at the time. So finally I met someone who was willing to sponsor me because I was nuts and nobody wanted to even be around me at that time. And he was like, "Well, you got to do 90 meetings in 90 days." I'm like, I'm not doing 90 meetings in 90 days. You're crazy. And he's like, "Well, you either do 90 meetings in 90 days or I'm not going to sponsor you." And I was like, "Man, I can't do 90 meetings in 90 days. How about if I do I'll do a meeting Monday, Wednesday, Friday. I'll catch two on Saturday, two on Sunday." So I'm sitting there trying to negotiate with this guy, and he wasn't having it. And it was like, "Well, maybe I'm not the sponsor you're looking for." And for some reason, when he said that to me, it kind of like, wait a minute, maybe you're messing up here. Maybe you ought to listen to this guy. So I started going to a meeting every day, and and I would call him every day like he told me. I was getting phone numbers like he told me, and I would call and I would bitch and I would bitch and I would bitch about my life and bitch about my life, and he would always say, "Work the steps." "Work the steps, whatever." And one day I was like, "You know, that's your freaking answer to everything. Work the steps." And he's like, "Precisely." I went, "Oh." So I had one of those aha moments. But still, I still wasn't willing to do anything. Yeah. So a year of white knuckling in the NA fellowship. Now, I'm still going to a meeting every day. I've become addicted to the meetings. During this time, my wife and I get back together, and I'm doing meetings every day, sometimes two, three meetings a day. And that's all I was doing for my recovery. Finally, I worked the first step, and this is how they were working the steps in this fellowship, or how this sponsor, particular sponsorship family was working them, is they would give me these handouts, and I would take them home, and I would answer these questions, and then I would take them back to him, and we'd sit down and critique my answers, and if it wasn't good enough, I'd go back home, and I'd rewrite them until he was satisfied, and that's how we worked the steps. And so this went on endlessly, and it took me, better part of 2 years to work 9 steps. Because my 4th step was the war and peace of my life, starting from my earliest memory. It was 181 pages and took me 4 hours to tell him. But I got to tell you, it did have some benefits, because once I got all that out, I did see patterns. Once I shared it, I did have a huge release, and it was great. You know, it was freeing. But I was given a lot of the wrong ideas of what the steps were about. The 2nd step. When I was on that, I remember going to a member in the fellowship, and I asked him, I'm like, you know, higher power, that's God, right? And he went, oh, no, not necessarily. You know, a higher power can be anything. If you turn on this light over here, and it allows you to read that book, then that's become a power greater than yourself. It's about awareness of these things, and the powerlessness in the 1st step. It wasn't just I'm powerless and my life's unmanageable. No. I'm powerless over everything, people, places, things. And 2 is about the insanity, if I keep repeating the same mistakes over and over. And the 3rd step was about, doing something different. So I viewed the 12 steps as like this real self-help kind of thing. And that's what I was being taught. And that's how, the 6 and 7 was... you have these defects, and you're always going to have them right here in your back pocket, and you can choose to act out on them, or you can choose not to act out on them, and these are the kind of things that I was being taught. If your ass is falling off, get your ass to a meeting. We'll help you sew it back on. And these are the things I'm hearing, and these are the things I believe. Oh, God speaks to you through other people. So I was using the fellowship as my higher power. I would go to a meeting, dump all my shit in a meeting. I was treating the meetings like they were a therapy group. And I didn't want to go to a speaker meeting. No, I can't share in a speaker meeting. Screw that. I want to go to an open discussion. Yeah, that way I can share first and get my shit out there before everybody else one-ups me. Because that's basically what happened in most of the meetings I went to. So, I started, they said, you got to get involved in service. So, I did. I got involved in the helpline and rose up to be helpline chair of N.A. Oh, boy, my shit didn't stink. Boy, talk about stroking some ego there. So I was at area service all the time. I'd have my subcommittee meetings on top of hitting a meeting every day, 2 or 3. Never missed a single event. If it was a picnic, if it was any type of dance or anything, I was there, And one night, I'm at home, I'm getting ready to walk out the door to head towards a meeting. My wife stops me. She says, nothing's changed. You're still never home. I'm like, what do you mean? I'm clean. I'm coming up on 3 years clean here. I said, you want the old guy back, the one that used all the time? I have to do these things. This is my recovery. I have to do all these things, because that's what I was being told. I had to immerse myself, put myself in the middle of the boat in order to stay clean. I have to do a meeting a day. I have to go to every event. I have to do all these things. I have to do service work, you know, because they told me anything you put in front of your recovery, you were going to lose. So I had to do these things or else I was going to lose that, you know, my wife and kid at home. If I didn't go to all this stuff, I was going to lose them. You know, and she was like, nothing's changed. I'm like, you don't understand. It's because you're not an addict, you don't understand. And I wanted to make her understand. You should go to Al-Anon. That's what I told her. You should go to an Al-Anon. And I talked to people, and I'm like, she just doesn't understand. She just doesn't understand. Needless to say, things got really bad at home. She had her room, my son had his room, and I had my own room. And this is how I lived for 3 years. I was living in a loveless marriage. You know, I was miserable at home, but I didn't want to leave. It was like a double-edged sword. It was like, if I leave, I lose my family. If I stay, you know, I got a wife that openly tells me she doesn't love me. You know, telling me to move on, and then when I go, okay, I've had enough, and I get ready to walk out the door, she talks me into staying. So it was just a really weird time for me, you know. And I remember telling people, I'm like, you know, I love my job, I love the fellowship, I love my, you know, my sobriety, but I don't like my home life, you know. So in a ninth step, because my sponsor at the time told me that I was others and I needed to make an amends to myself, which I later found out that I am not others. In order for me to make an amends to myself, I couldn't allow her to treat me like that anymore. So I had to leave. So in a ninth step, I left her because I had had enough. I had the right to be happy, and she wasn't going to beat me up anymore. So I left her. And it was hard. 2 weeks after I left her, I ended up losing my job, my place to stay. And I'm sitting there, and I'm like, wow. Because, you know, everybody was telling me, too, dude, you need to leave her. You need to leave her. She doesn't love you. You need to leave her. And I'm sitting there going, wow, 2 weeks ago, I had a family, I had a job, I had a home. Now I'm here with nothing. I'm like, boy, this recovery is something else. So, and I'm in a lot of pain. And, you know, I take my ass like they told me to a meeting. To have them help me put it back on. And you know what? They didn't. You know, I thought I had all these friends in this fellowship, and all of a sudden, it was like when I was experiencing some pain, all of a sudden, people just, like, orbited around me. They left me. And I'm sitting here, like, holding the bag, going, where are you people now? You said you'd be here for me. You know? Where's all this love and compassion y'all are talking about? And this went on for a little while. I eventually found a job and found a place to stay. But, I mean, that kind of hit home with me. It was like, where are all these people that said that they'd be there for me? And they weren't. So, trying to fill this now void that I had, I started going out to bars and clubs and stuff, not to drink, to look for companionship. And that's what I did. I would go there and I'd drink my soda, and I'd look for those one night stands. And that's what I did, and I did a lot of it. And I justified it. Well, I'm being honest with them. I told them I don't want anything. You know, I'm here for a good time, not a long time. And I justified it. If they get hurt, it's their own fault because I told them in advance that, you know, this is what it is. And I hurt a lot of people. And I did that for 6 months, you know. And first couple times I went to the bar, I was a little nervous, but I got through it, and I got through it okay. So I thought, look at my recovery. I can go in there, I can hang out, I can laugh at all these people getting drunk, because I don't have to get drunk. I'll sit here and just drink my soda, you know, and then, you know, let this guy pay to get her drunk, and I'll take her home, you know, on his dime, da-da-da. You know, I just thought I was just so slick. I really did. And this went on for a little while. Then one night after a meeting, me and one of my sponsees got into an argument. And then my sponsor got into it, and I was at odds with both of them. And I was like, you know what? Screw all you. I called up one of my buddies from the bar. She picked me up, stopped off, and I grabbed two tall boys, downed them, relapsed on alcohol. Now, 2 weeks before this, I told somebody, you know, I never had a problem with alcohol. My problem was all, I was a pothead. That's it. That's all I was. I would not admit that I had a problem with alcohol one bit, you know, because I had set that bar so high with my father. That's what an alcoholic looked like. I didn't look nothing like him, you know. So that's, you know, I relapsed on alcohol 10 days short of 3 years. So I came back the very next day, and the thought had occurred to me that, you know what, I was at a meeting last night. Nobody knows that I went out and had those drinks. I don't have to give up my helpline position. I don't have to give up my clean time. I don't have to give up none of that because nobody knows. And then a voice came in my head and says, you know. And that's when the guilt and shame set in. I went in and I picked up a white chip. Spent 10 days. Went out. Stayed out. For a few years. Gradually, I maintained for the first little bit. You know, I had convinced myself that, oh, I can do this in moderation. And moderation lasted for about a week or two. And then I was just full-blown drinking every night. And then I was drinking and snorting a little bit of coke. Then I was drinking, snorting a little coke, doing a little meth. Then I was drinking, snorting a little coke, doing a little meth, strung out on meth. Got to the point to where I was closing down the bottle clubs every night. I was taking the bottle. No, I wasn't even just closing them down. I was closing them down and taking everybody from the bar with me to my house to party. And that went on for a while until I had gotten so strung out. I was staying up for weeks on it. The last time I had stayed up 2 weeks. After 5 days, you start having hallucinations, and I was seeing shadow people. I was, you know, and I would drink to level out the drugs, and then I would do the drugs to level out the drinking. I was like this master chemist, you know. I would keep everything, you know. I'm a little too drunk, so I need to do some of this. I'm a little too much of this, so I need to drink. And finally, I scared myself to the point to where I felt that everything was coming down around me. So I sold everything I had, hopped on my motorcycle, and I was heading to Vegas. I was getting the hell out of here, because here was bad. And I didn't make it to Vegas. I made it as far as New Orleans. And my motorcycle broke down there. And 4th of July weekend, I was like, hey, I'm in New Orleans, 4th of July weekend. Yeah, I'll party. So I stayed there, partied. And went to hop on my bike, and it broke down. I was like, crap. So I was like, well, I'll just get a job here, and then I'll continue on to Vegas, because there was this really good locksmith job in Vegas. company called Liberty Lock and Safe. They were going to pay like $80,000 a year, and I wanted that job, and I was qualified. So that's where I was going. Never even talked to the people, but I was going to go there and get that job, you know. So anyways, I wound up getting a really cool job in New Orleans, became the locksmith for, guess who? The Navy. Yeah, for the Navy, a facility company for the Navy. So here I am, I've come full circle, you know, I'm a locksmith working on a Navy base. I thought that was really freaking cool. I was like, wow, my life just went full circle. So I had been on the road for about 2 months, so I was able to pass a drug screening. my drinking every night caused me to, you know, I was drinking on the job, smoking weed on the job. You know, I cussed the project manager out and thought I was actually going to keep my job because I was so good at it. He was going to keep me just because, you know, I'm Dominic. Don't you know who I am? And anyway, I lost my job. So I started to work for another company there, Rocks, Lock, and Safe. And 2 weeks after I started there, Hurricane Katrina hits. So we evacuate. Go back after the storm, and that place was just, it was, I can't even explain how that town was after the storm. It was just, it was a nightmare. It really was. So anyways, I'm working. I'm doing blow. I'm drinking every night. All my friends are barmaids and stuff like that. And I start slinging. And I start slinging to the barmaids. I go in and, you know, I drink for free, hook them up. They hook me up. And, you know, there were so many times I'd be on my way home. I'm like, I'll stop at the bar and have a drink and not make it home for 3 days. But yet, I'm not an alcoholic. Mind you, I'm not an alcoholic. Wouldn't admit it. Still wouldn't admit it. I'm an addict. It's all inclusive. I'm an addict, not an alcoholic. Okay? So, I meet up with, you know, and I'm still doing the one-night stand, still trying to fill that temporary void, a bunch of one-night stands. And I meet this one chick, and she wants to go to Jazz Fest. So I take her out to Jazz Fest, and she introduces me to the wonderful world of crack. And I eventually get strung out on crack. And I'm sitting on the edge of my couch in New Orleans with my gun in my mouth, ready to blow the back of my head off. Because I just didn't want to live this way anymore, and I didn't know any other way to live. You know, and I was sitting there. I remember telling myself, the steps don't work. Remember, you tried that. That shit didn't work for you. You know? You have no other choice. And as I'm squeezing the trigger, and I'm squeezing it, and the hammer's about to go off, a thought came in my mind. And it was a very loud voice. It said, "What about your son?" And I started to cry. I unloaded the gun. I called a friend of mine, "Come get this gun because I'm going to kill myself." And I came back here. Went back into NA. And there was a chick in this meeting, and I had remembered seeing her before from area when I was helpline chair, and I remember she used to flirt with me, but I was married, blah, 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 and I started talking to her because I still didn't know how to be alone. I didn't know how to be by myself. I had to have somebody, you know. I had to try to fill that void, and so I started talking with her, and she was like, calling herself a recovered addict. And I'm like, recovered addict? I mean, what the hell is that? You know, I know recovering addict. I said, so what, are you saying you're cured? She said, no, honey, no, I'm not cured. I said, well, what do you mean by recovered? And she started telling me about these people out in Brandon, and they go the recovered way, she was telling me. And I'm like, okay. She says, yeah, we work the steps really quickly. And I'm like, yeah, right. I had never heard of that before. So she says, just come with me. I'm going to take you out here. So I go out there, and they're reading out of this big book here. And I'm hearing things that I'd never heard before. They're reading out of the family afterwards. And in there, and I'm going to paraphrase this because I can't remember exactly what was being said. But they were he was talking about how the father had responsibilities at home, and how it wasn't the family's responsibility to understand. It was his responsibility to understand and to be the father. And I'm going, whoa, where is this? I've never heard this before. And it made me think back to when I was in the fellowship before, and how, you know, everybody told me, oh, you got to put your recovery first. You got to go all these meetings and everything. And it kind of hit me hard. It was like, I felt like I had been duped. Like I had been lied to. And when I was talking to these people, I knew what they were telling me was the truth. And what I had been told before was a, you know, I don't want to say lie, but just not how the program is supposed to be, if that makes any sense. And so they put me together with this guy. I'm not going to share his name, but they put me together with this guy, and he attempted to take me through the book, but my brain was so scattered, and I was still thinking I knew something about recovery because of all the things I had been taught or what I believed before. So it really didn't, you know, I went into it with a lot of half measures, and I got what you get with half measures. I got nothing. I didn't even go through, I think we went one day of going through the book, and I gave up on them. Needless to say, I went back out. Couple years later, another trip to New Orleans and back, I came back. And I go back to that meeting again. And, you know, there was just something about these people. It was the first time I could remember looking at somebody and going, wow, that person's glowing. I want that. Then the old saying, if you want what we got, you know, I was like, I want what he has. So I went up to him and I asked him, I was like, you know, will you take me through the book? And he started talking to me. I didn't know he was qualifying me, but that's what he was doing. He was qualifying me. And he was like, you know, I won't work with you, but I know somebody that would work with you. And he explained to me why he wasn't going to work with me. He says, you know, I'm basically just an alcoholic. I don't have, you know, I don't have the drugs that you have in your story. He says, but I know somebody that does, that has been through this way. And they put me in touch with, and I hope, do you mind? And they put me in touch with Toby. And Toby, I called Toby, and we got together, and we got through, I believe, 9 steps. You know, things were, I was feeling really good. And then something happened. I can't even remember what. But I kind of blew Toby off and went back out one more time. A couple years pass. I come back. I get back in touch with Toby. This time, my ass is 100% whooped. 100%. And I surrendered completely. And that's what it finally took. And then as we were going through the steps, I remember when we hit our knees and did that third step prayer, I felt a presence. And I was on fire. And that fire hasn't gone away. The intensity of going through the steps of the big book is indescribable, the relationship I have with my higher power today. You know, the steps are exactly what they say they are. There's no hidden meanings. There's no read between lines. And it is exactly what it says it is. You know, step two was my higher power. And I did come to believe, finally, after years of being around the fellowship, being around the program. And today, you know, I'm not around the program. Today the program is in me. And I live it. And I live it right out of the book because it tells me exactly how to do it. I mean, what an amazing concept. It's right there in black and white. All I have to do is what it says. And I get these gifts. And that's what they are. You know, all the promises have come true in my life. I do have that feeling of neutrality. I do have that, you know, feeling that, you know, no matter what, God has me. You know, and I look back, and I look back even through my relapses, and I see where God played a part in all of it. You know, I had a lot of yets when I went back out. There's a lot of things I hadn't done, and I was throwing a lot of wedges between me and other people in the fellowship, how I was not like them. You know, I came back, and I started seeing, you know, where we're the same. You know, I read through Bill's story, and when I take people through the book, and I read through Bill's story, and he talks about that total despair he felt, that loneliness, quicksand stretched around him in all directions, and I was there. I felt that. You know, he talks about, you know, the combination of gin and high sedatives put him on the rocks. I was there. I did that chemistry of both. You know, I relate more with Bill's story on the emotional level. You know, granted, I was never in stocks. But I know that man's story. I can feel his pain because I've lived that pain. You know, I've been homeless. I've been a lot of things. Since I've been back in the fellowship, God has led me back to school. Turns out I'm an honor student. Who knew? I'm smart. I didn't know. You know, I went from being a ninth grade dropout to I won the Students' Academic Excellence Award in architectural drawing and construction. I'm carrying a 3.964 GPA. And I'm an engineering student. I'm taking calculus, for Christ's sakes. I had no clue I was this smart, but God knew, and that's where He took me to. You know, and right now, you know, I got things going on in my life right now, but you know what? I just know everything's going to be okay. I just know. I have that relationship today. Where, you know, He tells me on a daily basis, and I hear God. It's not just a feeling. I hear Him. You know? I have conversations with God today. I have that kind of relationship. You know, I get funny looks from some people when I tell them that. But people that know understand exactly where I'm coming from. People that have that relationship, who have gone the recovered way, who understand the intensity of how wonderful this life truly can be. And it's not a slew of meetings. It's not just a fellowship. It's a relationship. It's friendships. You know, it's bonds that we have. You know, I'm truly grateful to this fellowship and all that it's given me, because by all accounts, I should be dead. And I've been given a life beyond my wildest dreams that I could have never asked for. And sometimes don't feel like I deserve, but you know what? God gave it to me, and who am I to question Him? You know, I spent a lot of years questioning His judgments, thinking I had a better idea. So today I try to pipe up when I, you know, get into that ego thinking I know what's best for me. And I kind of let Him show me where I need to go. Because I'll tell you, if you'd have told me back in 97 that I'd be an AA member and not an NA member, I'd have told you you're crazy, because I had something against AA. I did. I truly did. You know, I thought people hid out in AA because they didn't want to admit that they were addicts. Oh yeah, it's more appropriate. You know, it's more, you know, socially acceptable to say you're an alcoholic than an addict. But you know what the truth is I had a harder time admitting that I was an alcoholic. It wasn't a problem for me to admit I was a junkie. That was easy. But to admit that I was an alcoholic was tough. And it probably stemmed from my anger towards my father. The fact that he was an alcoholic and I didn't want to be nothing like him. I love you guys, and I thank y'all for being here, and thank you for letting me tell my story.
All right, Dominic B.